107.5 FM, W298DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News. Biden drops out. I'm Chuck Sievertson. The president says in a statement on social media that he will not run for re-election, and he endorses his vice president, Kamala Harris. Top Democratic House and Senate leaders and former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged Mr. Biden to drop out, according to sources. ABC News senior congressional correspondent Rachel Scott.
The president tweeted out, "It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president. While it has been my intention to seek re-election, I believe it is in the best interest of my party and the country for me to stand down and to focus solely on fulfilling my duties as president for the remainder of my term." The
latest high-profile lawmaker to publicly call on President Biden to bow out was West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin this morning. He's an independent that caucuses with Democrats. The Democratic National Committee Credentials Committee has been meeting on a conference call. This is ABC News. A 12-year-old girl is charged with first-degree murder. Prosecutors say she suffocated her 8-year-old cousin in a bunk bed they shared at their grandmother's house in Humboldt, Tennessee. The victim's mother, Rihanna Smith.
My baby was 8. She didn't deserve that. You know what I'm saying? Like, she did nothing to deserve being killed.
She says she believes it happened after an argument about a cell phone. South Korea says it's increasing its blaring of propaganda broadcasts through speakers at several points along the border with North Korea because North Korea's launched more trash-carrying balloons towards South Korea. The South's broadcast news of a recent defection of a senior North Korean diplomat. Annual Ernest Hemingway Days celebrated in Key West, Florida, come to a close today on his birthday. More than 60 years after the award-winning author's death, fans, scholars, and relatives gather on the island where he spent many years. Chuck Sievertson, ABC News.
My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and clear skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, risankizumab riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clear skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis. And visit SkyRizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
I'm James Kelly with WLAK News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. Find it anytime on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. The pandemic caused an explosion of telehealth services, but that flexibility could soon expire for people on Medicare. Eric Tegedoff reports.
A new report from the Bipartisan Policy Center details how Congress can improve telehealth. Without action from Congress, telehealth provisions for Medicare expire at the end of 2024. Maya Sandalo with the Bipartisan Policy Center says telehealth is especially important for rural states like Idaho.
We know that patients have to travel way farther than folks in urban areas to access care. Hospitals are shutting down and struggling to stay afloat. And so telehealth is really an important part of this puzzle.
Sandalo says Congress looks likely to give a 2-year extension to telehealth provisions, but she also notes that members should consider ways to ensure people can access this care. The report recommends 3 policies for Congress to consider if it extends telehealth provisions. First, she says policymakers need to consider the cost with a study from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services because there is some disagreement about whether it costs more than in-person care. Sandalo says CMS should also set up a way to track telehealth companies, noting that some might be providing care only over the phone without the option for video calls.
These companies are really important for expanding access to care, but there are some quality concerns associated with some of these companies.
Lastly, Sandalo says Congress should make some of the policies around telehealth permanent, such as doing away with location restrictions. She says telehealth is going to continue to be important to the healthcare landscape going forward.
Research finds that it can be really high quality, equally good as
compared to lowering prescription drug costs for seniors, and it expanding affordable health care for a record number of Americans. He goes on to list more of his accomplishments. Then he picks up and says, I know none of this could have been done without you, the American people. Together, we overcame a once-in-a-century pandemic and the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Then skipping forward, it has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president. And while it has been my intention to seek re-election, I believe it is in the best interest of my party and the country for me to stand down and to focus solely on fulfilling my duties as president for the remainder of my term. I will speak to the nation later this week in more detail about my decision. For now, let me express my deepest gratitude to all those who have worked so hard to see me reelected. I want to thank Vice President Kamala Harris for being an extraordinary partner in all this work. And let me express my heartfelt appreciation to the American people for the faith and trust you have placed in me. I believe today what I've always believed, and that is nothing. There is nothing in America that Americans can't do. We can do it together. We just have to remember we are the United States of America. The words read there, a letter from President Joe Biden to the nation being released a little while ago, saying he was going to stand down. He will not seek re-election. The first time, of course, this has happened since Lyndon Baines Johnson decided not to seek re-election so very many years ago. Joining us to discuss this, and we're doing this a little bit on the fly, so Jorge Arenas, who is doing an outstanding job as our producer, engineer, and Corey Hartman, I believe Trigvi Olson is standing by in the waiting room of our StreamYard broadcast. We'll bring him in whenever we can. But I want to go, first of all, to Matt Flynn, a two-time chairman of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, an attorney, a friend of ours, an ongoing contributor to Civic Media. Matt Flynn joining us via phone from Milwaukee. Matt, we spoke just last week, still up in the air, but Matt Flynn, I just want to get your reaction as a historian of these things and also a longtime member and activist in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Todd. I think this is a very dark day for the Democratic Party and for the United States. I think we can surmount it, but historically, here's exactly what happened. Right after one bad debate performance, a jackal pack assembled to drag Biden down. It started with the New York Times editorial board, the Washington Post, the media. They spent more time over the last few months attacking Biden and exaggerating what they were saying than attacking Trump. And I'll give you two examples. One is he was ahead. A poll just came out. He's ahead in Florida by 3 points. Florida. And where he's behind in some of these places is margin of error. And you don't get into a campaign until the nomination. And then he was our best chance to beat Donald Trump. The problem is when you have these Brutuses stabbing him, and I'm saying it started out with backbenchers. It started out with a few soreheads, but then it became Schumer, it became Pelosi, it became Hakeem Jeffries, it became Obama. And at some point, the diminution in the polls just recently, which was still margin of error, was a result of, hey, if the party doesn't want him, then why should we want him? So it was self-perpetuating. Now, fortunately, he endorsed Kamala Harris. She's his vice president. People forget, and I'm just going to lay it on the table right now, that in the past, when Biden showed any weakness in polling, besides age, the other one was Kamala Harris would be his successor. That was seen as a weakness. So we are now giving everybody a hair of the dog remedy. Why don't you vote for her in November? So we'll stand by her, but this is going to be a long slog this fall.
Trigvi Olson joining us via StreamYard from our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., our ongoing contributor. He joins us every Wednesday on our show. He was with us in Milwaukee for the majority of the Republican National Convention, senior advisor now to the Lincoln Project, a former Republican like myself. Trigvi Olson, your reaction as someone who's worked on presidential campaigns, in particular the late great Senator John McCain on his presidential campaigns, amongst others. What is your take on President Biden's announcement that he is withdrawing from the race? And yes, in fact, as Matt Flynn said, he has endorsed his Vice President Kamala Harris.
So, you know, with the Lincoln Project hat on from the beginning, we always said, you know,
were about Donald Trump and defeating Trumpism. So whoever the Democratic nominee was going to be, we're going to back. And we founded the organization when we thought really that Bernie Sanders was going to be running against Donald Trump in 2020. So that said, I don't know, you know, Matt, I love Matt Flynn. But the bottom line is Joe Biden, after the debate, was not a viable candidate to get to win the state of Wisconsin. It, regardless of what the public polls were showing, I have access to numerous private polls. I talk to people on the Democratic side who have access to massive polls, not 1,000 sample in Wisconsin, but literally 5 or 10,000 in the sample. The bottom line is people had concluded, and this was true even in the first big survey that we did in April of 2023, it isn't just that people thought that Joe Biden was old. They were worried, does he have the faculties to serve a second term? And the debate really crystallized it in people's minds. You know, in some models that I saw, Joe Biden went from probably winning Wisconsin, if he did, somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 to 4,000 votes, to down 60,000. And so the reality is it just wasn't sustainable. And Todd, you and I ran into that when we were traveling around the state both times, the concerns. You can't have a situation. Joe Biden, Tammy Baldwin didn't campaign with Joe Biden in Madison. Mm. So Joe Biden has had an incredibly successful term and in office with what he's done with NATO, with what he's done with the infrastructure bill. But the reality is time is undefeated. And it was time, and the Democrats probably should have done this sooner. It was time to move on. It's a little bit like Jordan Love coming in for Aaron Rodgers. People don't like that. Or Aaron Rodgers for Brett Favre, because none of us like to face our own immortality. But now the race will be back being about Donald Trump. That is what it has to be about. And the fact that he is old and he is not only, you know, appearing to be demented, but he's flat out crazy and he'd like to end democracy and make a retribution tour. So that's what this race is going to be about now. And if it's Kamala Harris who Biden's it backing and that's the way it goes, we have to be defending Kamala Harris and we have to be defending any of the other people that could be and drawing a contrast with Donald Trump, because all of them are committed to democracy and he is not. And the question of whether Kamala Harris has the mental faculties to be president is not in question.
You're listening to a special report of Civic Media News. It's 12 minutes now past the hour of 2 o'clock. We're covering the breaking news at this hour that President Joe Biden, Democrat, has announced in a letter to the nation this afternoon that he is not going to stand for re-election and has endorsed his vice president, Kamala Harris, to be the Democratic nominee. When Democrats gather at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago next month, Civic Media will be there. We are going to go in a minute for a recap to Savannah, one of our great news anchors at Madison. But first, I want to go back to Matt Flynn. Matt, I think that there's going to be a lot of debate amongst Democrats for a long time. I personally hope, as Travey kind of laid out, let's move forward because, we have to defeat in a lot of Republicans, disaffected right. Republicans like Travey Olson, a lot of Democrats, a lot of independents, that the point here is to defeat Trump and Trumpism. To help us walk through, as an attorney, Matt Flynn, and also a two-time chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican, was making his rounds on the morning news shows this morning and saying that Republicans, at least in select states, are going to attempt to stop this in the courts. And their argument is going to be almost what Democrats have leveled on Republicans and Trumpism, that, hey, there are primary elections around this country and millions of people voted and they nominated Joe Biden. So are the Democrats the one who are ignoring election results? They're going to try to stop this in the courts. Matt Flynn, you're an attorney. Help us sort it out.
Yeah, well, I was at a convention where this happened in 1980. And there was a change in the party rules in the 80s. Here's what happened. Ted Kennedy ran against Jimmy Carter. And the Kennedy delegates were asked, well, switch your votes to Carter. And they refused, but they could, because under the rules that were changed in the 80s, you are not committed, unlike an elector in the Electoral College, in a party convention, you are not committed to vote for the person you were selected for. The First Amendment right to do that within a party overrides the equation if you were an elector, and then you're not supposed to switch. So what's happened is Joe Biden has endorsed Kamala Harris. That's it. They will go there. They've got to do it before August 7 because Ohio has some trickery in its laws to try to keep the Democrat off the ballot. If Mike Johnson brings these lawsuits, all of the Biden delegates, every one of them, are going to vote for Kamala Harris. She'll be the nominee. And they're going to have to say, well, Your Honor, Biden was voted in the primaries. Now, that does not matter. Those delegates can do whatever they want anyway, and now they have the go-ahead from Joe Biden. And unless you get a, frankly, a corrupt judge like Clarence Thomas or somebody like Mercedes Cannon down in Florida, any judge can read precedent. And so I don't think there's a problem at all. This also solves a financial problem because she can succeed to the money in the campaign, whereas if you brought in a Mark Kelly or a Gavin Newsom, there'd be some questions about that.
We are, this is a special report by Civic Media News. It is now 16 past the hour of 2 o'clock. I'm Todd Allball, joined via phone by Matt Flynn, two-time chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, an attorney as well, our ongoing friend and panelist. Also, Trigvi Olson, former Republican like myself, now senior advisor to the Lincoln Project, joining us from our nation's capital in Washington. I want to ask both of you what may come next. Now, the attention is going to turn to a potential of the vice presidential pick, but before I do that, I'm going to throw it to my colleague Savannah with a quick recap of where we're at right now. Savannah?
Sure. So what we've learned today is that these discussions have been going on since the debate. Since the debate, there have been politicians at first privately, then it kind of turned to pushing publicly, starting to mount pressure on President Biden to withdraw from the race. And you see that when you see statements start to come in within about 2 minutes. That means that the party has already started to kind of unify around a message, because that will be key for them, especially heading into the nomination process next month. But I think a lot of people have been kind of waiting for this and kind of waiting for this statement and waiting for this decision from President Biden. So when we got that this afternoon, it started with his kind of, I would say, surprise just out of nowhere, saying on X on social media that he was stepping down, endorsing Kamala Harris in that same message, which I think tells us a lot. I also just saw some more information from CNN that says that some major Democratic donors have already released statements saying that they are backing Kamala as well. So we're really going to start to see more and more unity behind the Democratic Party, because that will just be key for them as they shake up this race kind of heading into their convention. And I think they will... I mean, every time I'm out and I'm talking to people or interviewing people about November and about this election, the thing that they say to me is, oh, it's the same two people. And this was a way for people to be less tired of the same race that we had 4 years ago. And that may end up benefiting them in the end. Stands to be seen.
Thank you, Savannah. I really appreciate it. And again, about an hour now or so ago, President Joe Biden chose to release a written statement, White House saying that that is in part because the president is still recuperating from COVID. Any of us who've had COVID know your voice kind of goes, and so that may be part of the reason. We don't want to speculate too far, but the White House deciding to do this via a letter to the nation that read in part from Joe Biden, quote, "It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president, and while it has been my intention to seek re-election, I believe it is in the best interest of my party and the country for me to stand down and to focus solely on fulfilling my duties as president for the remainder of my term. I will speak to the nation later this week in more detail about my decision," unquote. Again, that is part of the written letter released by the president now going on an hour ago. I want to bring our panelists back into the mix. Trigvi Olson, senior advisor to the Lincoln Project in Washington, D.C. Trigvi, lots of talk, even as early as Thursday, lots of chatter on who may now be turned to for the vice presidential nominee. People like Andy Beshear, governor of Kentucky, who a former attorney general there who has been reelected to a second term there. He's a guy who says that, you know, he's not for assault weapons bans. He is for red flag laws, but he also supports LGBTQ rights and supports Roe v. Wade. Then you've got Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania, the new governor there, who is, of course, Pennsylvania, a key state. Roy Cooper of North Carolina has been mentioned. And, of course, Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, another must-win state, although Whitmer said earlier last week she had no interest in running for the VP. But Trigvi Olson, you've been around these national campaigns. Nobody wants to be the vice president until they're asked. Trigvi, I think maybe Trigvi, your mic is muted there. Let's try that again, please.
Muted me. Okay.
All right. There you
so
go. Go ahead.
So a few things. That is 100% true about the vice presidency, unless it's Dick Cheney. I'm just trying to make Matt laugh with that joke. So here's a few things. One, my take as somebody who's run, you know, campaigns at those kinds of levels, particularly in the key states, there's really three choices, and I don't mean to disparage Tony Evers, but he ain't going to be vice president. That just isn't going to happen.
Surprise, surprise, as Gilbert Powell once said.
He would be, and as I've said before, I'd love to have Tony Evers as my neighbor if I can convince my wife to move back here, but he's not going to be VP. So there's really only three choices, I think. Yes, Andy Beshear, he's great, but they're never going to win Kentucky, and he doesn't add that much to the ticket, quite honestly. Other than he's moderate white and male. Rory Cooper, kind of the same thing. Maybe North Carolina goes into play, but the reality is if the Democrats are winning North Carolina, they're winning the election. There are four mm-hmm. states that matter, only four: Wisconsin, mm-hmm. Michigan, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. You have possibilities from each. You have Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania. You have Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. We're throwing out Tony. And you have Mark Kelly in Arizona. Pennsylvania's should be, in theory, it's the most Democrat of the four states. Arizona is the most Republican. Michigan and Wisconsin are the most alike. I think at the end of the day, one of the challenges that Shapiro has, and it probably isn't right, but Shapiro's first term, and he's Jewish, and of course, with some of the challenges that the Democrats have in places with large Palestinian communities, that might be a problem. I don't know enough about Democratic politics to know for sure, but it could be. Whitmer, the downside of Whitmer is, obviously, that's two females at the top of the ticket. In theory, that's an assumed. It might be, in fact, a strength. We don't know that. What we do know is that she's a two-term governor. She has a strong record, and she could probably counter J.D. Vance. She probably makes Michigan in the Democratic column, and she helps a lot in Wisconsin and maybe to a degree in Pennsylvania, and she's great contrast with J.D. Vance, who was picked solely for Midwest appeal. The last one is Mark Kelly. Now, Mark Kelly probably only helps in Arizona. He might carry Arizona for the Democrats, probably does. He probably doesn't help as much in Michigan and Wisconsin, and you can't win just with Pennsylvania and Arizona. You got to win Michigan and Wisconsin. If you win Arizona, you got to win Michigan or Wisconsin plus Pennsylvania. But Mark Kelly is an astronaut. He is an American military hero. And there's a lot of reassurance that might come with that. And he's a white dude. And Gabby Giffords, his wife, was a victim of political violence. So I think at the end of the day, it's either going to be Whitmer or Kelly. Quite honestly, again, as I say, we just have to, defeat Donald Trump.
Let me ask you quickly, Tammy Baldwin. Does she have Joe Biden looked at her. She was on the kind of top 10 list last time. She didn't make the top three. Any chance that it could be a Harris-Baldwin ticket?
Well, as you know, Todd, I love Tammy Baldwin. Tammy Baldwin and I don't agree on a lot, but she is one of the nicest human beings you'll ever meet. Would I be happy if somebody like Tammy Baldwin were Vice President of the United States? Absolutely. I don't think the Democrats are going to go there. And I don't think they're going to go there. Probably doesn't say much about Tammy. It probably says a lot about Tammy. They're not going to want to try and replace Tammy Baldwin and risk losing that seat to Eric Hovde.
Right.
And I'm not sure that Tammy seals Michigan. If you're going that route, you might as well just go Whitmer.
Matt Flynn, former two-time chair of the Democratic Party in Wisconsin. What are your takes on VP for if Harris is indeed the Democratic nominee?
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to two people. It's going to come down to Mark Kelly and Josh Shapiro, and here's why. I do not think that people vote for for a ticket, and they look at the VP and they say, "Oh, the state near me," and blah blah blah. Remember that Bill Clinton mm-hmm. took Al Gore from two young Southern guys from adjacent states. The point was the message was youth and forward-looking. Here you have Kamala Harris, as contrast to Biden, a contrast to Trump, but she's going to need stability. And there's a benefit to Shapiro and there's a benefit to Kelly. The benefit to Kelly is he's not only an astronaut, he flew over 20 combat missions in Iraq. His life was on the line a lot. Combat pilots, when they're being actually shot at, and astronauts have to make instantaneous decisions, and he comes across very strong. He'd be an excellent choice. Josh Shapiro would be an excellent choice. I do not think that people look at things like race and ethnicity as much as they did. Everybody said, don't nominate Barack Obama. Well, he won two terms. Don't, nominate Jack Kennedy. And he won. So I think when it comes to Josh Shapiro, he's a young governor. He's tough as nails. And he also, quite frankly, has stood up to a Republican legislature there. And he's very popular in Pennsylvania. So Trigvi's exactly right. Kelly and Shapiro give you a twofer. They give you swing states. I am not convinced, by the way, that except for the case of Lyndon Johnson with Jack Kennedy, that the VP brings along his state automatically. That said, I could almost bet that it'll either be Kelly or Josh Shapiro.
Thank you very much, Matt Flynn. Trigvi Olson, I know you're up against the clock. You got to go in about 2 minutes here. Anything we didn't ask you yet that you think is important?
I'm going to share a piece of research data that I have access to. So in the last 2 days, voters in Wisconsin, Michigan, were asked about how would they feel. This is Democrats, independents, and undecided Republicans. So once Republicans, conservatives are still on the table. Asked what one word open-ended. The overwhelming answer of almost 40% of people, and remember, this is they're not being given options, was either relieved or relief. The next most popular was disappointed, and then happy, and you had about 12% saying sad. I think what Chris LaCivita in the Republican campaign, the Trump campaign, and I know him pretty well, as you guys know, they are off balance about how to respond to this. You're going to see them throwing out, we're going to throw them off the ballot and all the rest. I watch the Sunday talk shows. If they try and throw them off the ballot, they're going to run into the buzzsaw of not only lawyers like Matt who are going to kill them in court, but they're going to run into a whole lot of people that are feeling relieved who are going to be the voters that decide this thing in the key states. And they're going to be looking at it. Why is Donald Trump so impotent and afraid of Kamala Harris or whoever the nominee is? And the other thing is, if Kamala Harris, which I have no doubt she can utter six coherent sentences in a row, Donald Trump can't do that. That is going to be a big contrast that we've had two politicians in their mid-70s, and now we got someone in their 50s. Sorry, man, I got to run because I have to get on a call.
Very quickly, did Donald Trump's life get more difficult politically today? Yes life? Or no?
Oh, 100%. And Chris LaCivita and Susie Wilds, magnitudes of it, because Donald Trump, I'm sure, is breathing down at their neck saying, you were telling me I'm going to get 350 or 400 electoral votes. Now what am I going to get? I'm backing up in a hand-to-hand combat to win Wisconsin and Michigan. And, for some of us, like on this call, Wisconsin's a home game. So let them bring it and try and win in Wisconsin.
Trevi Olson, Senior Advisor to the Lincoln Project. Always a pleasure. He'll be on our show from noon until 1 o'clock tomorrow on the Civic Media Radio Network. Thank you, Trevi. We'll let you go.
Yep.
Savannah,
thanks, guys.
One of our great news anchors, Savannah, do you have an update for us? And then we will wrap things up with Matt Flynn on the other side. Savannah, I will throw it to you.
Sure. So I've basically spent even just these last 20 minutes monitoring all the updates that are coming in, because it's just constant at this point with news this big. And it really starts with the dozens and dozens of statements from Democrats, congressional Democrats, Democratic governors, basically big players on the political stage on the liberal side. And overwhelmingly, they're really praising this decision, calling it a patriotic move. And then I talked to Congressman Mark Pocan maybe about an hour ago now, and he told me this is, quote, an honorable choice from a man who has consistently put his country first, end quote. But I also asked if he was relieved, because he had told me that he is constantly talking with constituents, and many of them say the exact same thing, and they were worried that Biden would not be able to beat Donald Trump. So he said he was relieved that now that question goes away, although a bunch more may now start to pop up with Harris or whoever else could emerge throughout this process. I just want to mention the money real quick, simply because that's one of the top questions. It can go straight to a Kamala Harris ticket, all the money that the Biden campaign has raised toward this point. Otherwise, it can be given to the Democratic National Committee. That's one of the things people always ask me about just in this last month when we've been talking about, okay, but if Biden drops out, where does the money come from? How do we raise money for a new candidate? And some of the people that have really praised this decision, something I just got in the last few minutes, was the Congressional Black Caucus. So I also just want to make the point that if Kamala Harris wins this nomination, she's the first woman of color to be nominated for president. And that would be a pretty huge moment, Todd.
Savannah Tomei Olson, outstanding reporting as always. Great news team led, of course, by our news director, Terry Bell. And apparently now coming across the wire, Senator Elizabeth Warren has also endorsed Kamala Harris as the nominee. Matt Flynn, one more chance. I'm going to ask you the same question. The two-time chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, an attorney, asking the same questions we asked Trevi Olson. Has Donald Trump's political life become more difficult today?
No, I absolutely think it has. And it's the kinds of lines of attack that he's going to do against her will differ somewhat from Joe Biden. But there's a couple of things she has to do. She is known for certain soft issues. She has got to make it clear that she unequivocally stands with Israel against Iran, against Hezbollah, against Hamas, against ISIS, everybody else. Number two, she stands unequivocally with Ukraine and with NATO. And three, unequivocally with Taiwan, just unequivocally. And if she does that, I think she has a good shot. But I personally am disappointed. I want to make that clear. Joe Biden could have won if the jackal pack hadn't dragged him down. That said, they did. Okay, we have a nominee. We got to get behind her, get her a good VP, and let's get going.
Right. Well, and I think that's a great distinction you make. And Trevi Olson and I and others talked about that this week at the Republican National Convention, that this now Trumponian MAGA Republican Party is one that is antithetical to the Reagan Republican Party, which was strong on international defense. Certainly Reagan would have never tolerated, in my opinion, I think Trevi's as well at the time, talk of being anti-Ukraine and pro-Putin, mass deportations, this sort of thing. So those are great points, Matt. The words of President Joe Biden from earlier today, reading from his letter, quote, "It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve as your president. And while it has been my intention to seek re-election, I believe it is in the best interest of my party and the country for me to stand down and to focus solely on fulfilling my duties as president for the remainder of my term. I will speak to the nation later this week and in more detail about my decision." Matt Flynn, two-time chair of the Democratic Party, an attorney, an ongoing contributor. We appreciate you taking time today with so much. We appreciate Trevi Olson, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project as well. And Savannah Tomei Olson, our Deputy News Director here at Civic Media, coming in today. We really appreciate you. And of course, our News Director, Terry Bell, our great team, Chief Engineer, Corey Hartman, and also Jorge Reyes on the board producing and engineering as well. And Sage Weil making it all happen magically on the board. And of course, our Program Director, Catherine Lake, Luke Mathers as well, and each and every one behind the scenes. These things are not easy, and we really appreciate everybody coming in on a Sunday. Savannah, anything else that you would add before we wrap up our coverage here on a Sunday afternoon at 2:34.
Get ready. It's going to be a crazy week.
It certainly is. Matt Flynn, anything we did not ask you yet that you wanted to say before we take the take leave of you?
No, one quick thing. Remember, you have to vet the VP candidates. In 1972, McGovern didn't vet his, and he had to throw him off the ticket when he realized he'd gone in for shock treatments. So I don't know beans about any of these guys, Kelly, Shapiro, and all that. Right. So somebody had better be vetting them right now.
Yeah, I think that's, and that was a case for, of course, Pete Buttigieg to be the vice president because he's gone through a national campaign. But probably for reasons that you and Trigvi have articulated, perhaps he is not at the top of the ticket. It could be Whitmer, could be Kelly, could be Shapiro, or maybe it's a surprise that none of us are talking about. Stay tuned to all of our great news and talk programs on Civic Media tomorrow. We, of course, will be live with you from noon until 2. Trigvi Olson and Matt Flynn will both join us on our show tomorrow, so be aware of that. And, of course, our great news team with Terry Bell and Savannah Tomei Olson and all the rest will keep you updated throughout today and into tomorrow on our hourly newscasts as well. For now, we are going to wrap things up here and stay tuned for Civic Media to civicmedia.us and our social media for further updates. Again, that's civicmedia.us and our social media at Civic Media's various social outlets. And of course, the Civic Media app, which is available at your Android or App Store. On behalf of all of us here at Civic Media, this has been a Civic Media News special report. It is 2:36. For all of us here at Civic Media, have a good afternoon.
Against Donald Trump, as they've been brought by both federal and state officials, he is charged once again in this case with illegally holding on to these classified national security materials after leaving office. That a source of no small concern, a national security concern about who else has seen these documents, who else had access to them at Mar-a-Lago, maybe in New Jersey as well, other places, raising issues not just about the paper movement, but about threats to our national security. And that's why this case has been and remains so very important. And along the way, after the initial indictment was returned by the grand jury, finding probable cause to believe that indeed those crimes had been committed, grand jury returns and says, we're going to add some obstruction of justice charges to this as well. In the efforts to retrieve some of the information there, obstruction of justice alleged against Donald Trump and against two co-defendants, two of his workers there. Remember their names, Walt Nauta and Carlos de Oliveira. Both of them, also defendants in this case, also dismissed by virtue of Eileen Cannon's omnibus dismissal order of just this past week. Special counsel Jack Smith, of course, responds. And he says this, he says the dismissal of his case deviates from the uniform conclusion of all previous courts to have considered the issue that the attorney general is statutorily authorized to appoint a special counsel and the Justice Department is authorized a special counsel to appeal that court's order. Indeed, that's exactly what Jack Smith has done following the issuance of this order, bringing to an end, at least for now, the progress of this case in front of Judge Eileen Cannon. He has appealed this decision to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. That is the Court of Appeals directly above the district courts in the 11th Circuit, including South Florida. This is the same court that on at least two occasions in the past has reversed, has rejected positions articulated by Eileen Cannon when it came to that civil attack on the conduct of the criminal investigation that preceded all of this. Now, all of that's very wonky. All of that's a lot to consume. But the bottom line is the 11th Circuit has already on two previous occasions told Eileen Cannon that she is wrong and reversed her and told her she's got to reinstitute not only the proper adjudication of justice, which in that previous case meant hands off, hands off when it comes to attempting to oversee the investigation. Now she's shut down. Now she's shut down the actual prosecution. We'll see what the 11th Circuit does. Highly likely, the 11th Circuit will follow what the Supreme Court has said and what all these other courts have previously said in deciding that special counsels and special prosecutors are in fact constitutional. In that 93-page order that is now on appeal to the 11th Circuit, by far the longest writing that she has issued since she has been handling this documents case for about a year or so, she offers what is admittedly an in-depth look at her legal reasons for tossing out the charges. At the heart of her thinking, again, was this assertion articulated by Clarence Thomas, articulated at much greater length by her in her exposition, that there's no specific federal statute that authorized the appointment of special counsels or gives them the prosecutorial power that they have wielded for almost a quarter century. Nothing constitutional either. Now, just as a way of some background here, special counsels are currently governed by Justice Department regulations that for a long period of time have been supported by federal laws that lay out the structure of the department and the specific powers of the attorney general. All of that has been established at least since 1999 when the Congress, the statutory authority here coming from Congress, establishes something called the Independent Counsel Act. And that at the time authorized, governed a different type of independent prosecutor. And that was at the time of the so-called Whitewater investigation into Bill Clinton's matters, not only with respect to Whitewater, but also ultimately Monica Lewinsky. Judge Cannon basically took a wrecking ball, if you will, to all of that and said that none of that is supported by the Constitution or by the statutory authority here. She declared that allowing special counsels to operate under the control of the attorney general was a violation of separation of powers. And she invites in this way, language I will read from the order, invites Congress to pass a new law if indeed you think that Mr. Smith should continue to pursue this and other cases against Donald Trump. She says this: if the political branches wish to grant the attorney general power to appoint special counsel Smith to investigate and prosecute this action with the full powers of a United States attorney, there's a valid means by which to do so. Now, all of that sounds good perhaps on the surface, but for the fact that it is simply wrong. And not only is there statutory authority, but it has been affirmed by the Supreme Court repeatedly in recent years, in addition to this appropriations, this funding issue, also a matter of review by previous courts. The judge in this case appears to agree with this argument that drawing funds from the Treasury without statutory authorization, good reason to believe that the appropriations clause violation here also happened. That's a separate independent basis. And of course, all of that comes together at a time when, as a result of this, the case now dismissed in front of her. Now, Justice Thomas never mentioned Judge Cannon in his concurrence, but he did recommend, once again, the lower courts take a look at that, and that is exactly what Judge Cannon has now done. The reality is that there's a great deal of history on this, as I've indicated, supported by the Supreme Court and other lower courts that have affirmed the capacity of the Attorney General to do just this. They've included the Supreme Court way back in a case called United States versus Nixon, 1974. Supreme Court upholding the appointment of a fellow named Leon Jaworski. Many of you may remember him. He was investigating Watergate, the obstruction of justice events at those times. And interestingly, United States versus Nixon, 1974, a unanimous court, 9-0, written by the Chief Justice. His name is Warren Burger. Warren Burger, writing for a unanimous court, says two things. One is, he says there's no such thing as executive immunity. That doesn't exist. That doesn't exist, United States versus Nixon, 1974. And he also goes on to say that while we focus principally on this notion, dismissed, that there is executive privilege, there's executive immunity, the reality is that there is, in fact, constitutional capacity for the special prosecutor at that time, again, Leon Jaworski, to investigate, finding expressly in United States versus Nixon precedent for decades that this kind of thing can, in fact, be done. And it goes on. During the course of the subsequent years, we know well that that same notion, gotten different names, special prosecutors, special counsel, it has changed over time as the Congress has tried to wrestle with this issue of authority and how exactly a special counsel, a special prosecutor is to operate inside the Department of Justice, and yet with sufficient integrity and apartness from the Attorney General to ensure the American public has confidence in that process. As the courts have gone along, they've reaffirmed this basic notion that you can, in fact, have special prosecutors and special counsel. They did it in the investigations involving President Ronald Reagan. Remember the Iran-Contra scandal? Same thing affirmed there. President Bill Clinton, as I just said, in the Whitewater-Monica Lewinsky scandal. Same kind of thing. President Donald Trump in the Russia 2020 campaign interference investigation. All of those. Special counsel, special prosecutors, all of them affirmed by the courts, overruling and finding expressly, as did the Supreme Court, that Congress has indeed, contrary to what Eileen Cannon says, and yes, what Justice Clarence Thomas says, Congress has vested in the Attorney General both the power to conduct criminal litigation of the United States, and here we go, to appoint subordinate officers to assist in the discharge of those duties. The statutory authority is there. The constitutional authority is there. The Supreme Court has said so. Other courts have addressed this. And indeed, those same principles also animate recent investigations. We know them well. Right now, the investigations of Hunter Biden, who was recently convicted in that firearms case in Delaware, he is going to be sentenced sometime soon. He's also awaiting trial in a tax matter out in California. Those cases also being prosecuted, again, inside the Department of Justice, but by special counsel. In that case, a fellow named David Weiss. Those prosecutions also supported by all of this precedent, and indeed also precedent for the investigation of President Joe Biden. He was investigated, remember this, for possessing government documents, a finding by Robert Hur, the special counsel in that case, also justified in that investigation judicially, and finding in the end that there's no basis upon which to pursue an investigation of the president for that, finding in the end that there would not be charges against him. All of those recent cases being brought by, being investigated by, being pursued by special counsels, pursuant to the clear statements by the Supreme Court that this is permissible, contrary to the express opinions issued by Eileen Cannon and by Clarence Thomas. And so what happens in the wake of the clarity of all of this and the wrongness of the decision issued by Eileen Cannon, seizing on this one issue and getting rid of everything else? Well, we know what's happened once again. We know that Jack Smith has already appealed this decision to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, bringing this up and certainly going to be arguing in the months ahead, based upon briefs and oral arguments to the 11th Circuit, a three-judge panel there asking once again that the 11th Circuit reverse Judge Cannon, as they have done on two previous instances, telling Judge Cannon once again that she is wrong and asking that this case be reinstated based upon the fact that her bases for dismissing the case are not well-founded, are not consistent with precedent, and are inconsistent with the law as established by the Supreme Tribunal in our country, the United States Supreme Court. He has done that. And sometime in the next several months, the appeals court presumably will entertain those arguments, both written and oral, and decide on that issue, almost certainly going to say that indeed Eileen Cannon is wrong, and implicitly, that Clarence Thomas is also wrong. Note in his concurrence, nobody else on the Supreme Court joins him in that view. Nobody else agrees with Clarence Thomas on this issue. Likely to assume that nobody else agrees with Eileen Cannon on this either. Now, there are a couple of other remedies that Jack Smith could consider, and he certainly has, no doubt, inside the Department of Justice, thinking about what do you do in the wake of the dismissal of this very important national security case. How do you remedy this matter brought on by a judge who is engaging in what many have called a lawless decision? Two of the things that he plainly can do. One of them, of course, he could ask the 11th Circuit to seek her recusal, ask them to remove her from the future pendency of this case. Let us assume that at some point down the road, the Supreme Court does indeed reinstate this. He could also ask that she be taken off the case. He hasn't done that up to now. That's an option. As Amicus Law Review continues, I'm going to tell you about another option that's out there for the special counsel as he addresses this decision by the district court in South Florida.
Lake Air, 1260 AM WLAK.
Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion, yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Banning abortion, monitoring and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK, Amory's home for Matinee on Air.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Amicus Law Review, my name is Jim Santel, your host this hour and also next hour when we talk about the Supreme Court and lower courts in our nation. Talking right now about this major decision by Eileen Cannon to dismiss the documents case, one of those four criminal prosecutions proceeding against Donald Trump, who is now the nominee of the Republican Party to become the president of the United States of America. Another option that is out there for Jack Smith that all the prosecutors certainly identified, he is apparently not going to pursue this. It's not clear whether he's going to ask the 11th Circuit to recuse Judge Cannon, assuming that it sends this case back to the district court, reinstates it. Not clear that he's going to ask that she be taken off this case, although that is certainly an option that is before him. Maybe the 11th Circuit would be interested in at least considering that. Hasn't done so yet, at least not publicly in pleadings. But there's another option that apparently he is not going to pursue, and that is simply to reindict. That is simply to go back to a grand jury, a new grand jury, as they did in this case, and present the evidence again to that grand jury. No problem here. No problem at all with double jeopardy. Jeopardy is not attached. Nothing about this violates the Constitution. To go back to a grand jury and say, we're presenting this evidence anew. We're asking you to determine whether there's probable cause and do that. Do all of that, not through a special counsel, but have the attorney general or someone in the criminal division address the very issue that Eileen Cannon has apparently identified as being problematic. If you don't like the special counsel, Judge Cannon, we'll do it another way. We'll do it the way that 90%, 99% of all the cases in America are prosecuted. What we're going to do is we are going to assign this to someone, a trial attorney in the Department of Justice, no special counsel, no special title, no special prosecutor, an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Florida, in the District of Columbia, maybe in New Jersey, a trial attorney in the criminal division, the public integrity section of Maine Justice, a mainline prosecutor, a civil servant there for a long time with this experience, no special counsel appellation, no special counsel designation. We'll do this as we normally do. Have that attorney prosecute the case. We get out from under this problem that you've identified, Eileen Cannon, inappropriately, wrongly, as being problematic, but we can pursue it in that way and get this done as well, alleging virtually the same crimes as before and reinstituting this case, addressing, if you will, the problem the judiciary has identified, at least these two, a justice and a district court judge, and getting this case back on track. And the advocacy to do that, of course, would be nothing wrong with doing that constitutionally or statutorily, but it's a strategic decision that Jack Smith can, in fact, make if he wants to do that. He has chosen to go down the appellate road. The appellate road almost certainly longer in duration. Unlikely, almost impossible to believe that under either path, this case will go to trial. The appellate route going to require, again, oral arguments and motions and memorandums, a decision probably in 2025. You go the other route, a re-indictment of the charges, as a grand jury may, in its discretion, determine to do. That process can go forward in the next weeks and months and return to the docket, whether it is in South Florida, in the District of Columbia, all places where there is what's called venue, the possibility of bringing this case. The best one is probably South Florida, where most of the documents were found, discovered, retained. But we also have a tendril there in Washington, D.C., where the documents were taken out of the White House. There's certainly an indication there's something going on in New Jersey. Some of the documents were there as well. You've got venue in a number of different spots. You could consider that. But you can also consider doing this, again, assigning it to an assistant U.S. attorney in South Florida and saying, prosecute this case. And go ahead and restart this process, get the arraignment underway, get the motion practice underway. Whether it's assigned to Eileen Cannon or another judge, that is a matter of, again, of course, for judicial administration. That is another remedy that is out there. We will see how all this plays out, continue to report on it, and describe further what happens in the wake of this momentous decision, a decision by Eileen Cannon that virtually everybody on all sides of the political aisle and all sides of the legal aisle, if you will, all ideologies look at this and say, this is cannot and will not stand. We will see what the 11th Circuit does. Unlikely the Supreme Court is going to embrace this notion either. We do know that in the wake of all of this, that this has caught the attention of the President of the United States of America as well. And in particular, although he has not announced it with great clarity, President Joe Biden has indicated that he is going to make some proposals, both statutory and legislative, to address what he has identified as a number of different concerns and challenges, out-and-out problems that many of us, including the president, and people, again, on all sides of political aisles have identified with respect to the management, the administration of justice, and even the behavior of the justices on the Supreme Court. The president said just this past week that he has been working with constitutional scholars for the last 3 months on a package of reforms that will affect the work, the conduct of the Supreme Court. And he said, I need some help. He said, I'm going to need your help. And he's talking to the American public, your help on the Supreme Court. Because he said, I'm about to come out with some proposals that have been under consideration. He says, I don't want to prematurely announce it, but I'm about to come out with a major initiative on limiting the court and what we do, a major initiative limiting the court on what we can do. Presumably based upon all the indications, he may in fact be calling for a constitutional amendment that could limit this broad presidential immunity that the court's conservative majority has just issued as of July 1. That's a big lift. That is a big lift. And that may be a part of his package. And it may in fact be a part of what he's going to propose. Of course, the president has also described this immunity package, the immunity issue, rather, the decision as being a dangerous precedent and that there are virtually no limits on what a president can do. An amendment, however, to the Constitution, as we all know well, would presumably face even greater challenges. It would require 2/3 votes in Congress and presumably ratification by 3/4 of the state legislatures as well. That's no small thing. But it underscores the focus that the president has in rejecting the powers that have been given to him by the Supreme Court, establishing a kingdom, if you will, in the presidency, as many have said. He's rejecting that and also saying we need a constitutional amendment to overcome what the Supreme Court did in this recent case, United States versus Trump. In our next hour, I'm going to tell you more about this package of things the current president is proposing, including likely issues related to term limits and also an enforceable code of ethics. Term limits, and also a code of ethics on the justices. All of that coming up in our second hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media on Amicus, a law review.
This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK. Crude and Dom.
Join the Devil's Advocates on Monday. We've got Congressman Mark Pocan. He'll tell us why he's advocating for Joe Biden to step down as the presidential candidate for the Dems.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in quick podcast format? Search no more. Find it now on the WLAK website at lakeair.radio. Your news just for the Amory area. I'm James Kelly with WLAK News.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us. You're listening to Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK Amory and 107.5 FM W298 DK Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.